Go 3 weeks without preaching, so it's so good to be back and to be with you. And over the course of the last several weeks, I've been thinking a lot about new beginnings. You know, officiating a wedding last weekend with good friends and seeing the potential that lies ahead of them is exciting. Thinking of where we're going as a church and Franklin and Sarah moving up here next week and onboarding with us and the possibilities that lie ahead of us that God is orchestrating and ordaining in our lives is exciting. Even Friday night, we packed up a Penske truck for our own Deb Long, who's on the worship or was on the worship team. I'm not going to get emotional, but she's moving to Florida, or already has moved to Florida. She's en route now, and it's exciting for her. She's sad to leave her church family and some of her immediate family that lives here, but she's excited because of the possibilities that lie ahead. Even for graduation, this weekend, last month for Nate, next month for me, thinking about the possibilities and the potential that lie ahead. The limitless possibilities and directions that these young people have in front of them is amazing. Who knows where their adventures will take them? And you know, I think for many of us, we long for that fresh start. We long for that new beginning. For some, it's just that we feel like our story, too much of our story is behind us and too little is ahead of us. And so some of us look at these young people and think, what would I give to be able to turn back time and recapture some of their youthfulness that so many of these young people possess? They have so much potential and I'm just so tired. A lot of us are tired. Still, hallelujah. Still others of us, though, we struggle because when we look at our lives and we look at ourselves in the mirror and we see the person staring back at us, all we see are our mistakes. We see our poor choices, our bad investments, our unfortunate relationships. And some of us, we live in a constant state of regret, and they wish that they could go back and start over and make different choices, different decisions, have different relationships, choose different paths. And for many of us, we've gotten to the point where we've decided that who we see in the mirror is set in stone. This is who we are now. This is our identity, for better or for worse. It's who we are. It may be a source of shame, it may be a source of pride, but when we look at our lives, we're convinced that this is it. What you see is what you get. And for some people, the source of shame and regret, when they look at themselves in the mirror, they've convinced themselves there's no fresh starts in their future. In fact, one of the conversations that I had early on a couple years ago when my brother was arrested was with my mother, who was in despair because in her mind, this was it. My brother Jacob, 19 years old at the time, was a criminal, and that's all he would ever be. Her words specifically were to me, his life is over. Unequivocally, no doubt in her mind, Jacob's life was over. And in fact, I had a conversation that was similar to that with Jacob not long after that, and that was a similar worry for him. And I told Jacob the same thing that I told my mother, is that when God is involved, nothing is set in stone. That his life wasn't over, and that this did not have to define him. Because what came next for Jake and what may come next for you or for me is not defined by external forces. Yes, at the time when I talked to him, it was out of his hands whether he would serve time in prison. Certain things were absolutely out of his hands, and you probably feel the same way, that there are elements in your life that you cannot control. Others might treat him differently on the outside. He may struggle to find a job that he wants because of the limitations that his arrest and conviction would have. But ultimately, the thing that would make or break him moving forward was not the people on the outside, and weren't the people that would give their opinion, often unsolicited. But Jacob's next steps were, and still are to a very big degree, were wrapped up in the story that he chooses to believe. Would he choose to believe the voice telling him that this is it, this is who he is now, this is his identity, and it is set in stone, and there is no going back? Or would he believe the voice of God? There's an old Casting Crowns song that says, the voice of truth, that tells him that there is still something more for him, because with God, there is always the opportunity for a fresh start. Would he choose the voice of God or the voice of the lie? And the choice of whose voice are you going to believe is not new. In fact, it's as old as time itself. It's a reality faced throughout the scriptures. The people of God, the ancient Israelites, are a prime example of a people that were forced, often of their own accord. In fact, one of the things I love about reading the Old Testament story of the people of Israel is, I guess for lack of a better term, how dumb they are. Because they continually made stupid choices, and if I'm completely honest, I often make stupid choices myself. And so I see some of myself in some of their mistakes. But God continually, again and again and again, revealed to them that that is not who they are. They are not their mistakes. And in the book of Jeremiah, which is where we're going to pick up our reading today, we're going to kind of come into the middle of another narrative of the people of Israel reaping the consequences of their actions. In fact, at this time, if you know the history of Israel in the Old Testament, Israel isn't even a unified country anymore. There has been a separation into two kingdoms, the kingdom of Israel, which are the 11 tribes, 11 of the 12 tribes, and then the kingdom of Judah. Well, Israel is already paying the consequences of their own rebellion against God and have been conquered by an outside force. But Judah had been faithful to God, at least up through the conquering of Israel. But somehow, some way, they didn't learn from the example of the older sibling. Rarely, if you're younger in your family, I often would tell my younger siblings, don't make the same mistakes as your older siblings did. But very rarely do they listen. Very rarely do they heed that warning. And Judah was no different. They learned nothing from the lesson of Israel, and they began to break their own covenant with God. And instead of remaining faithful to him, instead of relying on him for protection and provision, instead of loving him exclusively, they began to turn instead to other gods, worshiping them. And even further, they began to turn away from the guidelines and the commandments that God had given to them. In Jeremiah earlier in the book, we're going to be looking at Jeremiah 18, if you want to kind of flip there. Excuse me. And earlier in the book, we read that the magistrates and the rulers of Judah have become evil. and that injustice is ruling the day, and that the most vulnerable among them are being uncared for and being oppressed. And even worse, at this point, though it grieved God's heart to see them reject him, they had already begun to suffer the consequences of their rebellion. A drought had come into the land, and even the animals were suffering because of their rebellion. Worse still, there were rumors and rumblings that the powerful enemy of Babylon, who you've probably heard of once or twice, even if you aren't church people, Babylon had an empire that was practically unstoppable. And the word was that Babylon was rising up against Judah. And it was clear that if they did not change their trajectory, that they would fall into the hands of Babylon like their older brother Israel had. But in his mercy, God raised up a prophet, a man named Jeremiah, to speak to his people. And in the midst of their suffering, he extended an opportunity to come home. And in the middle of their punishment, he gave them a chance for a new story, a fresh start, one that would be entirely unlike the trajectory that they had set themselves on. And in Jeremiah 18, he uses a metaphor to offer hope to his people. Jeremiah writes, giving his own perspective. In Jeremiah 18, starting in verse 1, this is what it says. It's also going to be on the screen to my right and left. It says, "A message from the Lord came to me. And he said, 'Jeremiah, go down to the potter's house. I will give you my message there.' So I went down to the potter's house, and I saw him working at his wheel. His hands were shaping a pot out of clay. But he saw that something was wrong with it, so he formed it into another pot. He shaped it in the way that seemed best to him. Then the Lord's message came to me. He said, 'People of Israel, I can do with you just as this potter does,' announces the Lord. 'The clay is in the potter's hands, and you were in my hand, people of Israel. Suppose I announce that something will happen to a nation or kingdom. Suppose I announce it will be pulled up by its roots, and I will announce that it will be torn down and destroyed. But suppose a nation, I warn, turns away from its sin. Then I will not do what I said I would. I will not bring trouble on it as I had planned.'" Now, I'll be honest, this week, at least before the last few days, I knew surprisingly little about pottery. I mean, most of us probably don't know a whole lot. In fact, some of you that may have been alive in the 80s, all that you know about pottery is that one risque scene from that movie Ghost with Demi Moore and Patrick Swayze, and that's it. I mean, don't go rewatch that, because, I mean, it's pretty tame by 2018 standards, but it's still a little, like, cringeworthy to watch, especially thinking that your pastor just told you about it. However, if you are a parent, you probably remember that movie, and that may be the only time you've ever thought about the process of pottery. And if I'm honest, I don't think about it all that much. I don't think about manufacturing maybe as much as I should. But a few years ago, I actually went to this colonial historical village outside of Rochester. It was Genesee Historical Village. And it is actually one of the cooler things. If you're ever in that Rochester area, the Genesee Country Village is very cool. It's got several different eras of like neighborhoods from the, you know, pre-colonial era all the way through the late 1800s Civil War period. In fact, they're doing Civil War reenactments this summer. And they have everything you'd expect and even some things that you might not. They have old-timey baseball that they play on a field there, like original, like 19th century rule baseball. It's weird, but it's very interesting to watch. They've got blacksmiths and farmers, they've got seamstresses, and they have potters. And I think the thing that really intrigued me the most were watching pottery get made, because there was something about the way that the potter worked with his hands and the patience, the attention to detail, and as if by magic, watching him with his wheel. And the wheel continually was turning. and using water to keep the clay wet, he used his hands, and suddenly the clay starts to rise and form in his hands. And to me, you can kind of see it going on in the picture here. It really struck me as almost sorcery, like to this kid that's never done anything in his life with his hands, really. I've done things, just not made anything. I've never built something. And to me, that was sorcery. That was like, I don't understand what I'm watching, but I'm seeing a man take a pile of clay and form something beautiful. And to see him use his tools, to see him use a string to cut it to the way that he wanted it to be, to use a little metal and wooden tool to cut grooves into it. And finally, at the end, when it was just the way he wanted it, he put it in the fire. And the fire would remove any moisture, and it would compact it together into something that resembled stone. And that, to me, was incredible to watch, because I'd never really considered how pottery was made before. And I was amazed at how much he was able to do in the run of the day. You could actually buy his cups and his bowls, his goblets. It was an incredible sight. God, in this passage, he's speaking to the people of Israel, and the people of Israel are falling apart. Already the country is divided. They are going through a drought. People are recognizing that they're experiencing the consequences for their actions. But in the midst of their rebellion, God reaches out his hand to the people that betrayed him, rebelled in their hearts, and turned away from him, and told them a story of hope, telling them that it wasn't over. They strayed far. They had done things perhaps that they never thought they could imagine. But even now, their story wasn't over. And one of the hardest things I see in life is how many times people see their lives like a finished piece of pottery. You see, once the potter has put the pottery in, the clay in the fire, there's no going back. Better or for worse, if there are any blemishes that he discovers after the fact, it is over. He can't go back and fix it now. And too many people see themselves an awful lot like that. An awful lot like the finished product. Far too many people despair because they've made mistakes that have chipped away at their lives. And they know, because when I broke this morning, and I did it on purpose, when I broke this, I tried to see if I could put it back together. And the reality was, is that there was no returning this to the way that it was. And for some of us, with each passing decision that we make, we feel as though our lives break around us. And we look at our lives, and all we see is broken pottery from which there is no going back. And I met far too many young people and old within the church and without, that they despair to the point that they buy into the fact that this is who they are. They see themselves as broken and worthless, because you know what you do with this? I don't know about you, but when I have a broken pot, I throw it away. And too many people see their lives as worth nothing, and they're ready to discard it. But when I look at the story of God in the potter's house, and I see what he says to Jeremiah, it serves as a reminder that there is still hope. Your story isn't over. And this is not how God sees you. Day by day, you may feel like your life is falling to pieces. For some of you here, even, you may be feeling like you can't hold it all together. And maybe you've been trying, maybe for years, to use Gorilla Glue to get that thing to go back together. Because trust me, I tried, and Gorilla Glue does not work. Maybe I didn't try hard enough. But even if you get it back together, even if you put every single piece back together, it's not going to be the same. And for a lot of people, what they assume is that the best they can hope for is to maybe glue it back together and be useful again. But that is not the story that God is telling. Maybe you're here today and you feel hope slipping through your fingers. Maybe you feel like you have nothing else to offer. Maybe you feel like your story is over. Hear me when I tell you that there is still hope. Hear it from the mouth of Jesus himself. He tells a story that is, in my mind, at least similar to the one in Jeremiah, but instead of a nation in shambles, it was a young man. Perhaps you know it. It's one of my go-to parables that Jesus tells in Luke 15. He tells the story of the man that has two sons. And the younger son, he demands that his father gives him his share of his estate. So the father agrees and he divides his wealth between his two sons. And a few days later, the younger son packed up all of his belongings and moved to a distant land, and he wasted all of his money on wild living. And about the time his money ran out, a great famine swept over the land and he began to starve. And he persuaded a local farmer to give him a job feeding pigs. But he became so hungry that even the pods for the pigs were appealing to him, but no one would give him anything. And at this point in the story, this young man felt broken. This young man felt desperate. No doubt he felt an awful lot like this broken pot. He had gone so far. He had done so much. His story had been written and there was no going back. Scriptures say he came to his senses, but even then, the best he could hope for in his mind was to throw himself at the mercy of his father and hope that he would be allowed to become a servant. It was the best he could hope for under the circumstances. In his mind, maybe, just maybe, if he begged hard enough, his father will have some level of compassion on him. So he begins to walk home and he devises a speech. He says, "Father, I've sinned against both heaven and you, and I'm no longer worthy of being called your son. Please take me on as a hired hand." And he makes his way home, and Jesus doesn't say how long it took him to get there. But what he did say was that while the son was still a long ways off, the father saw him and went running to him, overjoyed at the sight of his son. Picture him throwing his arms around his boy and kissing him. And at the same time, this young man is trying to push him back and say, "Father, I've sinned." He's been rehearsing this, remember, the whole time. And he says, "Father, I've sinned against both heaven and you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father is having none of this. He's already busy planning the party to celebrate his son's return. The father didn't have time to even address the question. I can't imagine what was going through the son's head at this time. Because to him, his story was written. To him, he was preparing himself for the anger and retribution that he deserved, that he earned through his actions. And he expected his father to treat him as he saw himself, as broken and damaged and useless. The son had severed the relationship with his father, hurting his estate, but more than that, hurting his heart. He'd abandoned his responsibility and his family and his home, and for what? But he realized in that moment that in the same spirit that God spoke to Jeremiah, the father reaches out in mercy to his son, not condemning him, but showing him mercy, forgiving his egregious act of betrayal out of the depths of his love in the same way that God deals with us. Psalm 103, verse 8 reminds us that the Lord is compassionate and merciful, slow to get angry, and filled with unfailing love. The story of the prodigal son, the story that Jeremiah tells, that God brings to Jeremiah, is the hope that we can understand that God's love never fails, that it is deeper than our greatest sins, that it is wider than how far we try to run, and that his grace is insurmountable. There is nothing you can do that is larger than this. In verse 22, notice the father is too busy rejoicing to hear his son's speech. And this is what he tells his servants. He says, quick, bring the finest robes in the house and put it on him. Get a ring for his finger and sandals for his feet and kill the calf we've been fattening. We must celebrate with a feast, for this son of mine was dead and has returned to life. He was lost, but now he is found. You see, the words of the father don't sound like the words of somebody accepting a young man as a servant. Though he didn't deserve it by any stretch, and trust me when I say that this boy would not have been at his finest at this time. He was slopping pigs. He was probably dirty, and he'd just traveled for days on a dirt road. He's probably unbathed, unshowered, filthy, and sweaty from his long walk. But the father doesn't see the way the son sees. While the son may see this, the father sees something quite different. Imagine taking your best clothes, the most valuable thing you own, and placing it on a son like that. But that is the love that this father has. You may see yourself as a broken clay pot beyond hope and beyond repair, but that's not what God sees. Let's look back at Jeremiah 18. Remember that God compared his people as they mired in sin, reaping the consequences for their own betrayal, to clay, not to pottery. They had been unfaithful and reckless and selfish, all things that this young man in the story had done. But notice what God says to his people Israel. He says, people of Israel, I can do with you just as this potter does. You see, God doesn't see you as broken beyond repair. He doesn't see you as a piece of pottery ready to be smashed. Instead, what he sees is a lump of clay ready to be made into a masterpiece. And in the hands of a potter, a clay can be anything. It can be formed into a great work of art. The difference between broken pottery and a clay is that I throw this away. In fact, I actually reached out to a few people this week seeing if anyone had pre-broken pottery. And I had a couple of people that their response to me was literally, I just threw something away. Let me see if I can find it. The difference is that when you're a potter and you have misshapen clay, you don't discard it. you reform it. And for us today, for you maybe right now, what you need to hear is that your life is not beyond repair. It is not over. No matter how dark your life may seem, with Christ, your future is bright. Our God is a God of restoration. And he offers a new life, a new beginning, a new covenant, a new heart, and a new way of living. Listen to what God says to the very people that rejected him in Jeremiah. If you don't know the history of how this goes, Jeremiah brings this message to the people of Judah, this warning and this message of hope. But they basically decide, we're going to beat him up instead, and we're going to kick the snot out of him for trying to tell us to live a different life. And so Babylon continues their plan against them and overthrows them and sacks Jerusalem, destroying its walls and defiling its temple and taking the best of the Israelites into captivity and into exile in the land of Babylon. And though they deserved the punishment that they got, despite the fact that they were getting what they deserved and reaping what they sowed, God in Jeremiah 30 has some more things to say to them. He starts by defining their own predicament. In verses 12 and 13, he says this. He says, your wound is incurable, your injury beyond healing. There is no one to plead your case, no remedy for your sores. There is no healing for you. And yet to these stubborn people, these people who repeatedly rejected him, betrayed his love, to these people, God still offers hope. But I will restore you to health. I will heal your wounds, declares the Lord. I will restore the fortunes of Jacob's tent and have compassion on his dwellings. The city will rebuild on her ruins, and the palace will stand in its proper place. From them will come songs of thanksgiving and songs of rejoicing. Even Israel, who had done practically everything that you can imagine to betray the God that loved them so, God did not abandon them. And even though not that long before, they had decided to, instead of heed the warning, they decided to attack the messenger, God still offered words of hope. In the hands of the potter, there was hope for Israel. In the hands of the potter, there was hope. In the hands of the Father, there was hope for the Son. In the hands of our Savior, there is still hope for you and for me. Your life is not over. So the question that needs to be asked of you is the question that I asked of my brother: who are you going to believe? Which story will you embrace? Because God will not force you to embrace his way of thinking. God offers you his story, and he wants to make it your story. But you have to choose. And the choice that you make will define the way that you live the rest of your life. Will you choose the God who restores and redeems, the God who reconciles with even the most egregious of sinners? Jesus longs for you to make his story your story, to see yourself as the masterpiece in the making that he sees. He longs for you to come home. This morning I'm going to ask if the worship team would come back up, and as an opportunity to respond, perhaps you are feeling like you're in that place, you're in that position where you feel like your world is crumbling around you, maybe for you what you need is that reminder that even in the midst of the darkest night, that your time is not over, that this is not it for you. Maybe you're like my brother and you're suffering through the consequences of actions and decisions that you have made. Maybe people in the world are turning their back on you, but you need to know that God is not like most people. In fact, in 1 Samuel, we're reminded that God does not look at the exterior, but God sees the heart. Maybe today you need to embrace his story for you. His story that says that your life can change, that your outcome can be different, and that you can come home. I'd ask if you would stand with us. The altars are always open. If you want to come forward, if you have a need of prayer, if you want people to pray with you, you can stay where you're at. You can sit, you can stand, you can kneel. There's nothing magical per se about coming forward to the altar, but it's an opportunity to change the posture of your body to reflect the posture of your heart.